Hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. And my guest is one of my favorite guests. He's been on this program a lot, including a couple of weeks ago, David Steinberg. Welcome once again to the program, David Steinberg.
Thank you, Diana. Good talking with you.
Thank you. We always have lively conversations. And, of course, if you go to my website, drdianawiley.com, you'll see the cover of his book and also the archived version. You can also hear the archived version of our last show, which was on Tuesday, June 27th. So you can listen to that. And I encourage you to do it because David Steinberg, well, for 15 years, David wrote Comes Naturally. And this was a monthly column on sex and gender for Spectator magazine. And then the online audience switched over after Spectator folded in 2004. So you had a lot of really provocative columns that you wrote for Comes Naturally. And many of them are captured in your wonderful book, This Thing We Call Sex. And I really like what Michael Castleman said. Don't we all love Michael Castleman? He's such an amazing.
Yeah, I do. And yes.
Yeah, he's a good man, and he's a wonderful writer, just like you are. Good man, wonderful writer. So he says in the foreword to your book, the essays collected in This Thing We Call Sex are products of Steinberg's sexual journey, the development of his personal sexual interests and practices, and of his thinking about sexual matters, ranging from the sociological to the political to the philosophical. And that's all very true. And it makes the book a real page-turner, I must say. And for somebody who's read about sexuality for 35 years in earnest, I've always really liked your writings. And you know, we can, don't you find, even though we're immersed in the writing, or in my case, the practice in terms of my private practice and doing sex counseling, don't you find we can always learn new things about sexuality?
Oh, sure. It's definitely a topic that you don't hit bottom on. There's so many different levels of it and that are important to people in different ways.
And that's right. And you write in the foreword of your book, it's who we are, how we live, how we experience desire, yearning, joy, and life. Yes.
Yep.
So we were going to talk for this program about sexuality and politics. And
right.
That seems apropos, especially since the Summer of Love is celebrating 50 years ago. We're going to use it as a touchstone. And the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco has a Summer of Love exhibition, which my brother, who definitely would be interested in this, took my 95-year-old mother to last Sunday, and I don't think she's going to be so interested, but she loved the outing anyway. So where were you, David Steinberg, the Summer of Love, 1967? Where
were
you? Well,
I was living in Washington, D.C. then.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for a group called the U.S. National Student Association, basically doing work connected with the civil rights movement in the South at that time. That was my background, working on ways to connect college students in the North with what was was happening in the South, which at that time mostly had to do with getting black people to register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so my community there was not so much around sexuality as around political change. We all thought that there were many severe injustices in this country that we wanted to do what we could to move in a positive direction. And so we were actually part, at that point in the civil rights movement, what happened, Black Power was just coming out as a slogan. And the people that that I was working with from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee were beginning to say, look, it's time for white people have been useful in terms of providing support and getting the word out about what was going on in the South. But at that moment in history, it was important for black people to lead and this more than ever the struggle in the South. And what, the word that we were getting from people like Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown and people at SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was that it was time for white allies to begin working with white people to understand their own role in what was going on. And at that time, the discussion was shifting from what had been about discriminate, what people were focusing on as discrimination, to racism. And we were actually part of a group called People Against Racism that were the first people to really begin developing an understanding of what racism is in white people, how it works, what it means, and developing strategies for what could be done to make changes about that. And in the course of looking at all the underpinnings of racism, all the psychological benefits to white people of maintaining racist attitudes, we realized many things. But one of the issues that our particular group of people focused on was that sexual repression and teaching people to distrust their sexual impulses and basically disempower people by taking away their natural sexuality was a major way that the status quo maintained its status, its power. And so when we began to think about, okay, if we really want to make radical change in the United States, how do we make that happen? One of the issues that we took on seriously was looking at sexuality and beginning to talk to people about their sexuality in new ways, relating to monogamy, relating to gender roles being assigned, the way they were assigned to men and women, looking at the ways that people were taught to be afraid of their sexuality, suspicious of their sexuality, to basically view sexuality as a problem rather than as a joy. On that whole, you know, this is now we're talking, this is 1967.
Right.
So it's way back in time. So a lot of things that are now common understandings and common part of the dialogue this was new business back then.
New business.
We decided that we wanted to focus on a number of things, but one of the things that we wanted to focus on was looking at people's sexuality and beginning to challenge some of the kind of repressive assumptions that people made about ways that were okay and not okay to being sexual. And my wife at that time and two other people that we were very close to, that we kind of formed a family of four people, decided to move from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, which is where more people were looking at political change in these what we called cultural terms. So we moved out here in January of 1969 to San Francisco.
So you missed the Summer of Love by a couple of years, But
well,
you
we missed
came...
it in the sense of not being in San Francisco for it.
Exactly.
But, you know, nobody missed it because it was taking over the media.
There were repercussions.
At that time, it was such an explosion of sexual energy that... And it, you know, it, some of it was crazy, and but a lot of it was right on target. People realizing that they did not need to restrict themselves in the ways that were being demanded by the culture in the 1950s and 1960s up until that time. So there was this explosion. There was explosion of psychedelic drugs where people were doing having all sorts of realizations about what matters about life, what matters about their lives, what they wanted to do with their lives, and realizing that they had more alternatives. You know, men realizing they had different alternatives, women even more realizing that they had different alternatives from the limited paths that were being presented to them as acceptable up until that time. Mm-hmm. So everything was exploding. And in reality, although people like to discount the 60s as a failure, in my view, nothing has been the same since then.
Nothing has been the 60s held a promise that, I don't know, that love was coming to all of us. And then I think the decade of the 70s kind of delivered some of that love with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, in spite of the FBI and other difficult but the 70s was really America's unsurpassed decade of healthy, liberated sex for the most part. And
yeah, I think that's definitely the case, you know, and there, you know, there have been steps backwards since that time, all sorts of retrenchments, but there's no way that American culture is going back to what it was in the 50s. It's just not going to happen.
Right, it's not going to happen. And I think, you know, as I look back, I think that we really, we still have a lot of work to do because I think there's a truth to the rightness of sexual pleasure that is indeed a healing force that supports people and the planet. And we're in a really difficult time now, in, politically speaking.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think, you know, if you look at the, everybody's talking about how polarized the country is about any number of issues, you know, economic issues, racial issues, whatever, immigration issues. But if you look at how it all, a lot of that division lines up pretty exactly with people who basically are embracing their sexuality and doing and getting a lot of joy from that, and people who are fearful of sexuality and insisting on a much more repressive view about sexuality in general. And, you know, you see politically it comes up in any number of issues. It comes up, abortion is a big issue that's very much related to how you feel about sexuality.
Yeah,
so all of those issues, sort of a conventional, you know, what's come to be a conservative viewpoint. I mean, you know, you now have the attorney general talking about pornography being a social danger, you know, and yet pornography is embraced, whether openly or not, by, you know, overwhelming majority of the population, especially as time marches on and older people die off and younger people grow up being surrounded by pornography, you know, which has its pluses and its minuses, but it's definitely part of the sexual culture, and there's no way that that's going to go away.
No way, but we have some problems with this administration, and when we were doing an off-the-air pre-interview, you mentioned Alexander Lowen, MD, who was a student of Freud's, and I looked in my library, and I have this wonderful book of his, Narcissism, Denial of the True Self, and it was published in 1985. And I just want to quote this because it really somehow resonates in terms of our, oh, dare I say, our current president. And so I, as many of our listeners know, I live in Seattle, and I'm close to a fire station.
Yeah,
so we're hearing that right now. So this is what Dr. Alexander Lowen, very respected man, he says, power created status. The association of status with power extended the image of sexual potency to persons with power. This explains why so many women are sexually excited by and attracted to men with power. There would be no problem if power belonged to the superior individual, but that is not generally the case today. The reverse is often true. The man who needs and seeks power is, in most cases, relatively impotent sexually. Power is his way to compensate a lack of sexual potency. Power is the antidote to feelings of inadequacy and insensitivity on both the personal and the sexual levels. Well, so he wrote this more than 30 years ago.
Yeah, well, I think that that's very much on point. Lowen was a student of Wilhelm Reich, who had many of the same feelings. Wilhelm Reich was in Germany in the 30s as Hitler was coming to power, and wrote about sexual issues and authoritarianism in general, and it's reflected in what Lowen is saying there. People who don't deny their own sexuality, who embrace their sexuality, are empowered.
Mm-hmm.
Your sexuality is a source of personal empowerment. It gives you a feeling, not only literally in terms of sexual competence, but a sense of your own energy, your own power as an individual, which is why so many repressive governments are repressive about the sexuality of the people that they're governing.
Yes.
If you take away people's sense of entitlement to their own sexual power, you disempower them. And people who are disempowered are less likely to make trouble for the people who are in power in the world of money and being able to tell other people what to do, governments, religions, religious establishments, and so forth. So if you want to make it less likely that people will object to what, say, the government is doing, or what people in that kind of in political power are doing, one way to keep people docile is to make them feel like they aren't worth much. They don't have much energy. And the one really powerful way, that's one of the things that we realized when we started looking at the issue of racism. One of the really powerful ways to do that is to take that power away from people. And sure enough, I mean, look at the Summer of Love that you were talking about before. A bunch of young people flipped out, came to San Francisco, did a bunch of drugs, and suddenly found out that life could be just lovely, thank you very much.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, instead of being meek followers of what their parents were telling them to do and so on, all of a sudden you had literally millions, tens of millions of people suddenly realizing, oh, I can take charge of my own life. I don't have to follow all the rules that are being crammed down my throat by people who may or may not have my real interests at heart. And that was the beginning of that. And if you look around, it's not just the United States. If you look around the world, the countries that are the most sexually repressed countries in the world are also the countries that have the most authoritarian governments. And that's not a coincidence.
Well, that's right. And also, historically, authoritarian governments have not allowed much humor or joking. I mean, if we go back way in history, the court jesters were not allowed in authoritarian. They don't want people to laugh and have free rein and enjoy themselves, right? They've got to be serious.
Well, if you, yeah, that's true. I mean,
and no playful sex for sure. No playful sex.
Right. Right. So you come up with a set of sexual rules that are very narrow, so mm-hmm. that anybody the truth is that very few people, if they look honestly at their own sexual desires, look without fear at their own sexual desires. Very few people conform to the straight and narrow that has been, you know, the bottom line for, say, American sexual culture for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you must be heterosexual, that your sex should be confined to marriage.
Marriage.
That sex should not involve power issues except in very constrained ways. That your sexual partner should be the same race as you, should be the same age as you, that anybody who has any feelings outside of that very narrow strip of reality is taught that there's something wrong with them for feeling the way that they do. So instead of people saying, wait, this is how I feel, and yet I'm being told that I'm supposed to feel this way, there must be something wrong with these rules. People are taught to say, no, the rules are correct, and you're the one who's wrong. Furthermore, the word is, and not only are you wrong, but if we find out who you really are about your sexual desires, you will be punished. And in some cases, you'll be punished very extremely.
Yes.
One of the theories that I talk about in the book, in this thing we call sex, I call designated innocents and designated perverts. There's always been one group of people in the society, one class, sexual class in the society, that are designated as the current perverts. And I just don't mean perverts as people are outside the norm, but perverts who are so horrible that they're barely human beings, that we can do horrible things to them, and it's only because they are as horrible as they are. For a long time in this country, gay people were the designated perverts. These were people who were so twisted and so dangerous. They will take your sons and pervert them and do horrible things to them. So gay people came to represent the example. This is what we do to people who don't play by the sexual rules that we establish. The trouble with a designated group of perverts is that sooner or later, I mean, at first, the group of designated perverts are so afraid of being discovered that everybody hides in the closet, as they say.
Literally, yeah.
Eventually, some people come out of the closet, and enough people get to know the people who are being more outspoken about who they really are, that people say, oh, wait a second, these people are not monsters.
Mm-hmm.
They might be different from me. Maybe I understand them, maybe I don't, but they're not demons, you know, for good. And back, if you look back over history, the group that have been designated as perverts has varied. There's this wonderful book by Barbara Goldsmith about Victoria Woodhull, who was the first woman to run for president in the United States in the mid-19th century. And Victoria Woodhull was a big campaigner for what they called free love, which at that time meant simply the right of a woman to have a sexuality that was her own rather than a sexuality that revolved around pleasing men, pleasing your husband.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And at that time, any woman who had any sexual desire whatsoever was considered beneath contempt, so much so that it was fashionable among women to have their clitorises removed. And if women were experiencing sexual desire, it was so distressing to them that they would go to doctors and have surgery to have their clitorises removed to take this horrible energy out of them. Eventually, people like Victoria Woodhull and the suffragist movement that grew up at that time began to say, wait a second, this is ridiculous. We are as entitled to our sexuality as men are. Then it was, oh, okay. I mean, then meaning, so a couple generations go by, 20 years later, 30 years later, people have come to accept, I guess there are women who have sexual desire who are not horrible people. But a woman who has sexual desire who acts on it and has an affair outside of her marriage, oh, my God, she is beyond contempt. Then eventually those women become acceptable, and a new group of designated perverts needs to be found. And that's how it's moved through history in American culture.
Yes, and if I may just insert a bit of personal history here, because it's important, I think, to how I evolved as a woman with full sexual desires and wanting to be a sex therapist and so on. My maternal grandmother, who was born in 1889, was a suffragette. She marched in, she grew up in Brooklyn, she marched in the parades to get women to vote, or get the women's right to vote, and she was always a very sexual person up until she was in her 90s. And when I was in my 20s, I could talk to my grandmother, but not so much my mother. And I remember my grandmother saying to me, oh, Diana, I was born in the wrong generation. You are so fortunate. And she said, you know, sex is so life-affirming and wonderful. And there was some repression about, but she did her best to fight it, but there were so many roadblocks in her time.
Sure, and these things change slowly, you know. I mean, people get frustrated, but the fact that things change slowly does not mean that things don't change. You know, even in the 50s, women who were highly sexual were suspect, were considered suspect even more by other women generally than by men, and certainly considered themselves sexually suspect. Well, here we are, whatever it is, 50, 60 years later, and, you know, there are still young women growing up who feel that way, but certainly most women, young women, as, you know, they hit adolescence, I would think the number of women who currently hit adolescence start feeling sexual desire themselves and think that that means there's something wrong with them is relatively small. And to me, you know, this is a sign of how things really are changing. And I think it's important that we don't lose sight of that, even
yes,
as we're frustrated by how slow that process can be and how stupidly and determinedly people reject whatever factual information is out there. But being a sexual woman today is not the same as being a sexual woman even 20 years ago. Being a gay person today is not the same as being a gay person 20 years ago. These attitudes in the general culture have shifted, and culturally speaking have shifted, in fact, rather quickly.
Yeah.
You know, many of these kinds of changes take 50 to 100 years to happen. Issues about race, for example, another attitude deeply embedded in the American psyche, are changing
Yes.
Slowly, but
slowly.
Being black in America today, as unjust as our world is nothing like it was in 50 years ago or 60 years ago. Things have really changed quite a lot.
They have changed a lot. You know, I remember reading The Feminine Mystique. It was published in, I think, 1963. And I remember reading it on a long car trip between my college, Scripps College, and my pinned, which meant in those days, engaged to be engaged guy, who was at Pomona College. And so I'm reading this, The Feminine Mystique, out loud to him as we drove to Arizona, his home, for the spring break. And he was pretty shocked at some of the Feminine Mystique's messages. And for me, it was pretty amazing. It was kind of eye-opening. But she referred, Betty Friedan, referred to sex without self. She said women were love seekers, not sex seekers, and that we had sex to be loved, not because we love sex. And women, she also thought that women would never be able to really love sex if they were not orgasmic. Well, there's probably some truth to that. But I don't think that, you know, a lot of women, of course, these days, and I know this from my practice, I know this from life, I know this from lots of things, a lot of women don't have orgasm from intercourse, but the Feminine Mystique, of course. So, do you remember the book at all? Do you remember?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And
can you
it's interesting
on
what
that,
you're saying, because I mean that was a breakthrough book, and yet Betty Friedan was still saying it's about love and not sex. It was,
That's right.
I think part of that was she was trying to achieve legitimacy, and you could be much more legitimate saying, "Look, we're talking about love here," than if you're saying we're talking about lust here. So the idea of women experiencing lust, like just sex for its own sake, was still further than she wanted to go at that time. Maybe it's what she truly felt at that time, but it was certainly further than she was willing to go in public at that time. These days, that's no longer controversy. You know, for young women to talk about wanting to get laid, wanting to hook up, wanting to, you know, hook up with somebody, but I don't want to be in a relationship, thank you very much.
Right.
This is common.
And we have apps that support
almost to
that.
The point where the pendulum has swung to the other side, and people are saying, well, you know, if you don't care about relationship, you're really missing out on some important stuff, which is also, from my point of view, worth remembering.
Mm-hmm.
But to be, whatever, 15, 19, 21 years old now and saying, you know, I meet somebody, I want to be sexual with you, but no, I don't want to be seriously involved with you. That's, at least in most parts of the country, that's considered totally legitimate. It does not make you a slut.
Oh, yes. You know, in the early 90s, I went to a gerontologist convention in Atlanta. And because I am a gerontologist because of the research that Dr. Walter Bortz and I did in the early 90s. And that research on aging and sexuality was later published in medical journals. So after that, I got to call myself a gerontologist. Anyway, Betty Friedan was there at this Successful Aging, you know, conference in Atlanta. And I waited in line to have my book, her book, The Fountain of Age, signed. And I told her my story briefly about how I had read this out loud to the guy I was pinned to and how he was kind of shocked that I would want to do something outside of the home because he was a pretty conservative guy, a big rancher in Arizona, or his family anyway. And so I told her it was really a breakthrough for me, though. And she kind of was dismissive, and I was disappointed. She's like, you know, okay, move on.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah. I just, because I'd always kind of worshipped her
yeah,
in a way, well, because she was, her book was life-changing for me.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because it's, in a way, it shows how quickly things are changing, that you can read a book and say you have this person who is so important to you, and yet a few years later, you've progressed beyond where this person is. You know, because things are moving ahead so quickly that somebody who is revolutionary in terms of what they're talking about 10 years later are hopelessly behind the times. And it's
and maybe that was her, because she died a few years later, but maybe in some ways. Although, you know, one of the things I really liked in her book, The Fountain of Age, she said that as people age and as men die sooner than women, which is usually true, that some women who are open will take up having relationships with other older women.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, that's good, you know, because we all need to be touched and hugged and held. And even if we're not having intercourse, you know, we can have that kind of physical intimacy. And I liked that about her book, The Fountain of Age.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But again, you know, I mean, these days it's... people don't have to wait until there are no men around to decide that they are interested in being sexual with other women. And you know, that becomes part of what's acceptable. People, I mean, things have gone so far. Gender roles have changed. The whole concept of gender has changed. Dividing people into men and women is obsolete. You know, and I think that that's part, speaking politically, I think that's part of the reaction that we see in the country today. All the stuff that was so exciting to those of us who were in the middle of all those changes was also tremendously frightening to people who wanted things to stay where they are, or who needed years and decades to absorb the changes that were coming down the pike much faster than anybody was able to deal with. So you end up with people feeling like the world as they know it is being swept out from under their feet, and are confused and frightened and want to go back to the way it was before. And so you get a reaction. I think, you know, Donald Trump managed to crystallize a lot of that kind of fear, not only about sexual things, but I think sexual things were a huge part of it. But that so much was changing about the way of the world in the United States and the rest of the world as well, that it was more than the society could absorb without having some kind of spasm of reaction, and I think that's a lot of what we've been going through lately. Now, personally, I think that spasm of reaction has to happen, but when it's over, then things move forward again. Because I really think, historically speaking, you know, history is on the side of sexual openness, simply because once people become, you can only, in order to repress people, you have to deny reality about the nature of sexual beings. And you can only deny reality, you know, you can only fool some of the people some of the time. And eventually the truth comes out. And once the truth comes out, you can't stick it back in the bottle. You can't just say, oh, you know, we all thought that sex was really neat, but actually it's not. It doesn't work that way.
You say it so well. Now, we both appreciate Betty Dodson. I believe.
Yeah, Betty was, all the stuff that we're talking about, Betty was instrumental in. You know, she
Absolutely.
Did her first book, Liberating Masturbation, 1964, I believe, 61,
right.
Something like that.
And and I have all of her books, including My Sexual Revolution, and she inscribed the book to Diana, a sister sex educator with an overload of tea, which I love.
Yeah, Betty's wonderful.
Oh, she's wonderful. I know her. I've been to her apartment, and I've seen her a number of times. I have her art and so on. But this kind of gives some perspective. This is from that book, from the chapter Sex and Drugs and the FBI. So she says, when the March 1973 issue came out, this was Playboy, my statement had been rewritten, making me sound like a man junkie who didn't support other feminists. I was furious. After showing the photo and caption to my feminist buddy, she calmly said, when you do business with the enemy, you get burned. She was right. For days I stewed, hating the goddamn male establishment. For far too many men believed that equality for women meant a role reversal. If men weren't on top, they figured they'd end up on the bottom, and we'd treat them like they'd always mistreated us. How come they couldn't see that equal rights for women would allow men and women to stand side by side? I think that's a very strong political statement, and Betty Dodson knows it because she's now, I think, approaching 80, and she's lived it all.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, you know, but again, I think it's a sign of the progress over time. I mean, there are certainly still now, you know, we see it in all the stuff about sexual abuse and rape culture and all that kind of stuff. Young men who want women to be subservient to their, you know, to their desires, to be objects for them to do with and do to whatever they please.
Yeah.
However, that is, I mean, I don't know what the surveys show at this point. I'm guessing that is a minority of young males
today. I think that's
today.
Right.
Young men,
David,
today would like to have a partner who was hot sexually, who wanted to be sexual, who got pleasure from sex along with them, that they've got it, that's much more exciting for them, selfishly for them, than being with a woman who has not a clue about her own sexuality except to lie on her back and accept the sex that the men throw at her. And I don't know what the surveys would show, but you do a survey of men under 30, say, these days, mm-hmm. and see how many of them want an asexual partner. You know, life partner, let alone a sexual partner who just is passive and is just there as a vehicle for them to express their own sexuality. I just don't think that's the norm anymore. But it was, you know,
right.
You go back 50 years, you go back 150 years, it was definitely the norm. Any woman who did not feel that way you might hire her, you know, but you wouldn't marry her. I mean, hire her as a sex worker, but you
wouldn't. Yeah, I get it. I get it.
But you, but you wouldn't marry her because who would want to be with a woman like that? Well, no, nobody feels like. I mean, some people do. Most people don't feel like that. Most men don't feel like that. Most young men don't feel like that anymore. So.
I think it's been a very healthy, wonderful shift, and I see it in my practice because I have a lot of younger couples and individuals who are in their late 20s and 30s, and because I'm in Seattle and because they have good jobs, they can afford my fee. So I'm getting lots, and also because my website comes up on mobile phones, so I'm getting lots of younger people, and I appreciate that so much. So I'm hearing firsthand some of these attitudes. And it's refreshing.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
It really is refreshing, and I'm so glad. And of course, your partner Kim, right?
Yep.
And my partner Brian. They're wonderful people who are totally open and. I know Brian is a total feminist, but I don't even use that word with him mostly because it's just sort of part of who he is. It's a natural part of who he is.
Right.
And how is Kim? She's probably very open sexually.
Oh, yeah. You know, and...
Yeah.
So many people are. I mean, you know, historically, the history is on our side. You know, so many people are discouraged, and I understand why. I have a lot of friends and acquaintances in the transsexual community where people are still not only being dismissed but being murdered for who they are. So I understand
all of the horrors that are going on.
However, I think it's really important to remember that things really, history really is on our side. And to me, for me, when I deal with people who are on the other side of this great divide, you know, who are reactionary about any number of issues, sexuality, politics in general, whatever, it helps me to remember that what they're experiencing really is they are terrified because history is on our side, because it's so clear the way things are moving, and they are just in a state of panic about it and striking out wherever they can because history is essentially leaving them behind. And, you know, it doesn't make me any less accepting of violence or all the reaction that happens, but it does help me, how do you put this, not hate the people who are doing that. I end up, this may be condescending, but I end up feeling sorry for people rather than hating them. And I think if I have to choose between hating people and feeling sorry for them, I'm going to go for feeling. You know, I even feel sorry for Donald Trump. You know, I mean, this is a man who is doing horrible, horrible, horrible things. He is so obviously just this pathetic, broken, feeble person trying to just hold together some sense of personhood, you know. And, you know, of course it's horrible what he's doing, but this man is pathetic, you know. He is really broken. And so many
he's
of the
really
people
broken.
That are reactionary in this way, and I'm not talking about just conservatives. I think there are many honorable, strong, vibrant people who hold conservative political views. But the people who are really reactionary, violent, you know, extreme in that direction, if you look at who they are, you get their personal histories and stories that appear in the press and so on. They're broken. One way or another. Maybe they were abused as kids. Maybe they're just confused people who just don't know how to deal with the 21st century. But, you know, and sadly, broken people, especially if they happen to have a lot of money and power, get to hurt a lot of other people as they express their pain. But for me, I don't know, that's just the way it works for me. It helps to remember why they're acting the way that they do. And to remember
because, David, are a man of compassion. And,
well, yeah.
And you're deeply intuitive, and so you can look at these very broken people and kind of see maybe some reasons why. You know, I do that too. I still end up pissed off a lot. But I think that, yes.
No, I agree with you. I think compassion is a place of strength in my viewpoint. Bhagwan Rajneesh, who I know he goes by a lot of names, but he was actually, there's a lot of stuff about him, but he was actually pretty significant in my own development. At one point he said, anger is the absence of compassion. And I think many Buddhists have said the same thing.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
And it is. I've applied this in my own life in many ways, even in my personal relationships. When the people around you, when your partner is driving you up the wall, to the extent that you can say, why are they acting, you know, oh, they are being miserable. Why are they doing what they're doing that upsets you so much? As soon as you begin to see where their behavior is coming from, the anger, you know, at least partially, it goes away. And it doesn't mean that it makes their behavior okay. But instead of just saying you're an asshole, you get to say, oh, okay, you're upset about this, but now we're going to deal with it in a different way. And then you can move forward. I think a lot of couples therapy, couples counseling, works off of that model, you know.
Absolutely.
That you'd be able to see the reason behind the behavior that the other person is doing that is being bad for you. And once you do that, rather than dismissing the other person, and you know, this writ large, this is true on the political arena, but in writ small, it's true down to our most personal relationships. Once you move beyond that, then you're playing a whole different ball game. It's not like one person is good, one person is bad, one person is right, one person is wrong. Now we have two people acting out their stuff. Undoubtedly, both are flawed people. Both people have their own pain that they're carrying around and visiting on the other. Once you come from that place, one of the things that I most cherish in the relationship I have with Kim, just to be personal for a minute, is
yes,
she is so exceptional at being able to do that. And when we do that with each other, which we do, you know, we fall off the horse, but most of the time,
uh-huh,
we're able to move through issues, disputes, conflicts that could take a relationship and just throw it on the rocks. So I think
yes,
it's a big part of moving
huge
forward in a positive way.
It's huge. I'm able to do that with my Brian too. And of course, you know, some of this has to do with maturity and life experience. Don't you think? You know,
yeah,
we get a little smarter as we age, and we know what's important and what's not, and let's pick our battles, and then also it seems to me a perspective about love and life, and yeah.
But I'll tell you, I've seen the ability to be compassionate and understanding and non-judgmental in that way in 15-year-olds, in 18-year-olds, you know.
Yes, no, that's true.
It's really it's heartwarming. You know, kids who have grown up in families that operate in that way seem to have it as part of their DNA. You know,
right.
Just part of their normal way of existing. And I've watched, not just my own. So I've been through a number of relationships. I've had kids, stepkids that my partners have had. I watch how they work in their lives, and sometimes they are just stunning to me in their ability, to be that way. I certainly agree with you that, you know, certainly your path, my path over life has been to understand that more and more over time. And then sometimes I think that, the kids, when they're growing up, they have an intuitive sense of that. And if something doesn't take it away from them, they get to start there rather than get there 40 years later.
Well, at the risk of sounding like a bragging grandmother, I really do see this in my grandsons who are 5 and 7. I mean, they're, and my daughter is, and her husband are doing a really great job. But it's lovely to see. They're compassionate. They're intuitive. They're lovely little boys, and you know how little boys can be. But anyway, I'm looking forward to having a little Skype conversation with them tonight. David, thank you so much. This has been another really wonderful discussion. I'm going to have you back. This is officially part 2 for this year, but I want to have you back for part 3 soon. I hope you'll want to come.
Oh, sure.
Because you're just an amazing man with so many good insights, and you're so articulate. And I really thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Diana. It's really great talking with you. Thanks for such warm appreciation.
You're welcome. And you'll be back, I guess, next year. Oh, there's the music. Okay.
All right. Well, it's been great talking with you.
Thank you again, David.
Okay. You take care, Diana.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.